Welcome to the Teach the Geek podcast, where engineer and author Neil Thompson talks with STEM professionals about public speaking, a struggle for many of us. Whether you're a novice public speaker or a proficient one, you can always pick up tips on how to improve. Here's your host, Neil Thompson.
Welcome to another edition of Teach the Geek Interviews. My name is Neil Thompson. I'm the founder of Teach the Geek. I work with technical professionals so they can present more effectively, especially in front of non-technical audiences. And you can learn more about that at teachthegeek.com. Again, that's teachthegeek.com. If you're watching this interview on YouTube, a like and subscribe would always be helpful. And if you're listening to the podcast, well, you could always subscribe to that too, or review. Today, my guest is Jamie McMillan. She's an ironworker, speaker, and author. Now, ironworker, speaker, and author, I suspect, don't often appear in the same sentence, so I'm really curious to find out how she came to each of them. And she's also a champion for the trade, so I'm certainly going to ask her about that, too. So welcome to Teach the Geek Interviews, Jamie.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So from the intro, I said that you're an ironworker. So where did the interest in ironworking come from?
Well, there's a little bit of a twisted story to that. It wasn't my first choice, really, because I didn't know about it in high school. I didn't know that career pathways existed in skilled trades and tech. So I went on a little bit of a journey, did what my parents wanted in healthcare, and eventually came to a point in my life where I wasn't satisfied by my career. And eventually, in a part of my life where I started to feel really depressed and insecure about my future, I ran into an old high school classmate on the side of the road, 500 miles away from where I grew up, who told me about her apprenticeship and career as an ironworker. And it kind of piqued my interest. So I started looking into apprenticeship and found out that they had really great pathways where you didn't have to go back to college or university. It was a hands-on practical learning experience with 90% on the job training and only 10% of the time in school. And that was exactly what I needed to hear. And I ended up joining up knowing nothing about it. And here we are today.
Nice. You know, when you were talking, Jamie, you said that your parents had wanted you to go into healthcare. And that reminded me of even why I became an engineer in the first place. And I used to lie when people asked me that question. So I've done podcast interviews too. And when I first started doing them, when people would ask, what made you decide to be an engineer? I'd make up a story. And I had the story really memorized well, because oftentimes when you hear people talk about why they became engineers, it's typically interesting. Maybe they were in robotics club when they were in high school, or maybe they played with Legos when they were kids, or took apart the toaster or something like that. Well, I was never going to take apart the toaster. My mother would never have been happy with that. I don't even remember having Legos as a kid, really. And there was no robotics club at my high school. I became an engineer because my father said, become an engineer. And I actually stuck with it. So unlike you, you actually made the change. So I went through with it. I got the degree. I even got an advanced degree. I got a graduate degree. I even worked as an engineer for a number of years. So it worked out okay. But the whole idea of doing what your parents want you to do, I mean, it sounds good and all. And obviously they have your best interests at heart. But ultimately, you have to do what you want to do. You have to live for yourself and your wants and needs, not for the wants and needs of others. So I'm really glad that you found that person on the road somewhere, 500 miles from where you were, and they told you about ironworking, and it's worked out for you well so far. So that's great.
Well, you know what? Thank you for sharing that story, because it's interesting. I speak to about 50,000 students a year, and when I ask what they want to be, the majority of them will say content creators, and the other majority of them say engineering. So it is a career that students want to get into. They just don't understand a lot about it, especially in the earlier ages. But engineering is a great pathway, and there's a lot of pathways into engineering through skilled trades as well. So that's what I like to educate them about.
100%. So how does someone become an iron worker?
Well, I did an apprenticeship. So basically, once I got accepted to join, I went through a union hall, and then I went on to a dispatch list. And every time I went to work, it counted as hours towards that apprenticeship. So every 1,000 hours, I got a raise. Every 2,000 hours, I had to go to sit in a classroom for about 6 or 7 weeks. It was mornings in the classroom doing theory, afternoons in a shop class learning practical skills with our hands. And then after I completed 6,000 hours, which took me approximately 3 years and 2 months, I ended up writing the test called the Certificate of Qualification. I wrote that certification test. I passed and was awarded a journeyman iron worker, which I'm proud of that word because I believe it's a status, not a gender. I'm very proud to be a journeyman iron worker.
It didn't even occur to me when you said it's a journeyman, even though she's a woman. Maybe it would be a journey person, but you said it's not that big a deal.
Well, a politically correct way, and they're trying to change it in government, is calling somebody a journey person, but I see it as a bachelor degree. I got a bachelor degree, but I didn't have to pay for it. It paid me to get it, and it was called an apprenticeship, and now I'm a journeyman iron worker. That's my own personal belief. I love the status, and I see it as a status, not a gender.
All right. When you say bachelor degree, does that have anything to do with a man being a bachelor? Do they have anything to do with each other?
I don't know. I don't have a bachelorette degree, so I can't tell you.
Well, and then master. And when you think of masters, like masters tend to be men as well. You don't hear of female masters, do you? But this is so crazy. I never thought of it until you said it.
Well, I have a few friends that are master electricians. Wow. Very smart friends.
So as an iron worker, what does an iron worker do?
Well, we do the structural maintenance and repairs for a lot of buildings and bridges. So we basically put the skeletal structure inside of buildings and bridges, and that's the structure that holds it in the upright position. And then it also supports all the other components that are going to go in after, you know, the HVAC systems, the electrical and plumbing. It just supports everything and it supports the building.
Okay, so you have to work with all these other trades and to kind of make it so that everything kind of works together.
Yes, absolutely. We're always working as a team. There's always multiple skilled trades on a job site at the same time. And we're always working kind of over top with each other. So it's a lot of planning and collaboration in our efforts.
Okay. What's the career path of an iron worker?
Well, you're just learning as you're earning. So as you're going through your career, as I said, I was on the job experience. So I go to the job and I have to meet certain criteria to get through my apprenticeship. So I remember I first started, I was working at a steel plant. We were doing a lot of demolition and repairs. And you just, as you go through the process, you end up on different job sites working with different people, and you're often doing different things, which makes it great for somebody like me with ADHD, because it's a very diverse job. You can't get bored with it. But that's the whole process. You're just learning as you're earning. And then when you're going to school, you're learning more about the theory, because you're learning so much of the practical in the field, that those components, those blocks of schooling really help you understand the theory behind it as well. And once you meet all the criteria of what you're supposed to learn throughout your apprenticeship, then you write your CFQ.
All right. So then, you know, you could work as a, when I think of a career path, I'm thinking maybe you start off as an individual contributor and then you move up into a management type position. Is it possible for people who were iron workers to eventually become managers of iron workers? And kind of how does that work?
Every single skilled trade has incredible opportunities. In fact, I like to say that skilled trades have more opportunities to climb the corporate ladder than almost any other industry, because once you complete an apprenticeship, you become that certified worker. And then once you become that certified worker, you work your way up, you become a foreman, a general foreman, you can become a superintendent, a project manager. And then there's a lot of people that will be in the industry, and whether they're working steady for a company or they're working through a union, we also have trade improvement plans, where a lot of times they will go back to school to become maybe an estimator or a project planner or their own company. There's so many opportunities to expand your training and knowledge within the industry that the sky is definitely the limit. Like, there's no limit to how far you can go.
Well, okay. Globally
as well.
That's cool. So when you're an iron worker, you mentioned union, and then you mentioned working for a company. Are those the two, I guess, the two options you have?
Well, there's a lot of different pathways. There's unionized working environments. There is non-unionized working environments. There could be, I work as a dispatch worker through a union hall. So basically my name goes on a list. And as work comes up, we get called through that dispatch list. So we can constantly be sent out to other jobs. Oftentimes too, we can solicit our own work. So we might work for an employer and we get laid off because we're constantly working ourselves out of the job. But then, you know, if we find out that employer has more work coming up, we can always call them and say, hey, remember me, I worked for you. And if you've done a good job and proved yourself, that employer will often bring you back on to the next job as well. But then when you work in, say, an environment like a car plant or a steel plant, and you're an actual steady employee for that plant, you're not going through a dispatch list. You have that steady employment coming in and you're probably always working in that same plant. So it's a little bit more stable versus working in a union where we're constantly jumping from job site to job site across, sometimes even across the country. And some of my friends have worked globally.
Oh, wow. So when you were speaking, you mentioned dispatch and having to go to different sites. So does that mean you're going to be working with different people just based on the project that you're going to be working on? And if so, how do you go about kind of acclimating yourself to the different people that you're going to be working with?
Well, that's the fun part. It's also the most challenging part of being in the industry. So for me, I'm a people person. I like meeting different people all the time. And I like different experiences and different training and learning opportunities. So when we're constantly working ourselves out of the job, by that I mean we get hired to go and do a build or maintenance and repairs at a plant or an industrial site usually. And then what happens is when we're done that, we get laid off. So we go back to the dispatch hall. So we're all out of a union hall. Our name goes back on that dispatch list. And then we get called out to the next job. The fun part I find is that every single time I'm going out to a job, I meet new people. And oftentimes they don't know who I am. And I have to prove myself over and over again, which to me is a fun part of the challenge, but it's also giving me the opportunity to meet and make new friends and mentors everywhere I go. And because of that, I have friends from all over North America that I've met on job sites working across the country. It's pretty awesome.
You are the first person I've ever heard, Jamie, who said that by having to prove themselves over and over again, that's the fun part. So often when I hear people say they have to prove themselves over and over again, it's a negative. It's like, why do I have to keep doing this? What makes it so fun for you?
Well, you know, it wasn't always as fun in the beginning because I didn't, in the beginning, I had a little bit of more of a struggle with it until one day I was having some issues and I thought maybe someday I'm just going to quit this. Maybe I'm in the wrong place because there are some pretty difficult personality styles in every industry, but predominantly construction as well. And then one day a friend of mine told me, you know, success is the best revenge. So when you go out to a job site, see it as a challenge. The more they tell you you shouldn't be there or they tell you you can't do the work, that should be a motivator for you to prove them wrong. And it got to a point where I was like, you know what? Hell yeah, I want to prove them wrong. And I love proving to people that I can do something that they don't think I can do or that I have the knowledge and experience to complete certain tasks that they wouldn't anticipate or, you know, expect a girl to do. That's the part of my job that I love. I have taken their negativity and turned it into my positive motivation and drive, and it's become a challenge and I love it.
Wow. That's definitely a different way to look at things, because oftentimes when I hear people talk about these issues and the issue, you know, the problems of being accepted by the people who are there and having to prove themselves all the time, it just wears on them after a while and they just leave the industry altogether because it's not something they want to have to deal with on a daily basis. But for you, I mean, if you're able to see it as a challenge and I'm going to prove them wrong and I deserve to be here as much as anybody else, hey, kudos to you for taking that attitude.
Yeah, it's definitely the attitude I love. And, you know, they say if you can't beat them, join them. So I'm just going to do my best to be there. I believe we all have the right to be where we want to be. And if we have the work ethic and drive and passion, well, then go for it. It does take a thick skin and a good sense of humor, but thankfully I was raised with both.
Nice. So, you know, I mentioned also in the intro that you do as you're a speaker as well. So what prompted you to become a speaker advocating for the skilled trades?
It was interesting. When I first started in the industry, I was often the only girl on a job site. And I started to think about my own personal journey and how when I was in school, nobody told me that I could be in skilled trades. And I absolutely like kicked ass in shop class. So I started to think about the people that might have the same concerns or issues or experiences I had. And I started thinking, well, if I went out to schools and actually spoke to students about these career paths, because I wasn't told about it, could this make a difference? And could we see changes in the industry? So it originally started with me speaking specifically to women through efforts like Skills Ontario. So every province and state across North America has a skills chapter, and then there's the national skills programs as well. So I started with them and just started volunteering as a mentor. One day a panelist didn't show up. They asked me to go up on a panel. There was some tech teachers sitting in the audience that heard me and eventually approached me and asked if I would ever come to their schools and talk. And next thing you know, I went from being a mentor sitting at a table to a professional speaker standing on stages talking to 50,000 students a year across North America. It all came together. I don't know how, but I thank God and my everything every day, because this turned out to be such a great, epic experience and opportunity for me to make strides to change the face and the attitude and everything else in this industry.
When it comes to speaking in front of people, is that something you've always been good at? And if not, what'd you do to get better at it?
Interestingly, when I was a kid, my dad always said that I had been awarded with the gift of gab. So I've always been a talker. ADHD helps with that too. I never stop talking. But the way I ended up becoming a professional speaker, and I will tell you, the first time I got on that stage as a panelist, my knees were shaking and my heart was pounding, and I don't remember anything I said. But as I got more comfortable being on stages, I would honestly ask the youth. So if you're presenting to youth, the best way to learn how to talk to youth is to have them critique everything you do and say and how you present. So youth have named my company. They've helped me with the designs of my slides. They've helped me formulate the way I tell my stories in a way that is more impactful for them. Because I mean, as you get older, you start to lose that lingo and language that you use when you're younger, and it's always changing. So I really depend on youth. And then over the years as well, I've had educators and parents help me critique my message as well, to include very important factors in there. And to be very careful, you have to be very mindful when you're speaking, because you have to be careful how you tell stories. Sometimes when you're telling a story, you might not realize it, but you could be, being insensitive to somebody else without realizing it. A perfect example of that is when I talk about how one of my first careers was at McDonald's, and I was talking one time about how it was just sort of like this mediocre job and it didn't pay very much and I was struggling financially. And a young girl in the audience ended up going to her teacher feeling a little bit vulnerable, because I guess her mother was working at McDonald's and they were really struggling to make ends meet. And the way I spoke about it didn't make that sound like an appealing job. So I've just had to manage to twist the way I say things oftentimes to make it more relatable to students from all different backgrounds.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I suppose that could be an issue. Yeah. Maybe if they paid the people at McDonald's a little more, maybe you could see, it would be seen as a great job to have. Although, you know, historically working at McDonald's wasn't one of those jobs where you really want to have to be there for a long time. I mean, this is one of those jobs it's kind of like a stepping stone to something else. So hopefully that student's mother is able to find something that's a little more suitable. So when it comes to the presentations that you do you have a process for putting them together? And if so, what is it?
Well, I speak from the heart. I believe that I know my story and the message that I want to put out there. I do have a lot of vibrant pictures that I use in my presentations, oftentimes pictures to actually connect me, to show students that I'm not just up on a stage talking, that I'm actually realistically in the skilled trade. So I'll have pictures. I have videos that we've done of me doing different demos on the job site, or, you know, just being on a job site talking about some of the concerns, issues, or you know, mental health concerns on the job site. But for the most part, I just want to speak from the heart. I never know exactly what I'm going to say from presentation to presentation. I basically draw my energy from my audience. And if I can, I've gotten to a point where I can judge by the audience reactions, what's resonating with them, and I can really hone in on different subjects. And I also speak to the demographics that I'm in. If I'm in like a rural community where they don't have a lot of opportunity to expand outside of their, you know, they think their community is kind of the center of the universe. They've never been outside of that community. I will always talk to the community and how they can benefit their community and the world by entering the trades and how they can go about doing that within their communities. I really try to speak to the demographics.
Yeah, that certainly makes sense. I think the number one rule of public speaking generally is know your audience. I mean, you mentioned when you were speaking in front of the youth, you would actually ask for feedback from them is that what's the best way to speak for me to speak to reach you. And I think that's really smart to do, as opposed to, I know what I'm doing. I know my topic really well. I'm going to speak about it the way I want to speak about it. And you're going to listen no matter what. It's like, no, I won't. There's other things I can do. I have a smartphone now. When I was in high school, there was no smartphones. So I was either going to just have to, I don't know, just look at my fingers, look at the ground, think about what I'm going to have for lunch, just stare off into space. But no, you got a smartphone now. I could check my emails. I could go play a game on one of those apps. I could do a bunch of things as opposed to listen to you. So you definitely are competing with a lot of enjoyable and interesting things when you're up on the stage as a speaker. So getting the feedback from the people that you're actually speaking to is smart on your part.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and also learning how to use very impactful lines that you incorporate into your messaging. Like if you don't have a student within the first, 15 seconds of your presentation, you probably won't have them. So you've got to come out with a really big punch in the beginning. And I have a few big punch lines that I begin my presentation with to get those students engaged. And when I see them on their phones or if they're talking and being distractive, I have no problem calling them out either. And so when I call somebody out early on in a presentation, the rest of the students are then listening. And it's funny because I also speak about different experiences I dealt with very vulnerably. And because I do that, it triggers different students in the audience and they have a relatable story. So I think it's just, knowing your audience and how to talk to them and use those triggering messages to get them back in. And I can't tell you how many times I've had students come up to me at the end of the presentation and say, I've never, ever paid attention in a presentation in my whole life, but I heard every word you said. And it's like, oh, I love this.
Yeah, I've never paid attention to any presentation ever, including my teachers.
There's a presentation in the gym. Cool. I'm skipping class and going to my friend's house.
I really like your idea of calling out people too. It's like, hey, you over there, are you not entertained?
Yep. Yeah, I'll say to them, hey, like other people are trying to listen. If you don't want to listen, I will not be insulted if you get up and leave because this message isn't for you. And sometimes the teachers will go up and ask them, or do you want to go? And they'll be like, no, I want to listen. And then they listen and it's pretty neat. Sometimes it's just holding them accountable for their actions.
Yeah, good for you, man. It never even occurred to me to even do something like that. But I think that's excellent. Yeah, that's cool. And then everyone's staring at them and they got all embarrassed and stuff. It's like, yeah, maybe I should shut the hell up.
It's a very unique strategy though. So this is something cool that was, it was a teacher that actually brought this to my attention. So I always would bring my props from work. I would bring costumes that I wear to work. So my outfits, and I would show kids and I'd have it on a display. And one day one of the coordinators or teachers said to me, why don't you dress some students up from the audience? So I started, now when I go to schools, I usually have 4 or 5, sometimes up to 6 outfits that I bring to schools with me, and they're authentic workwear that I wear on the job site. So I bring it to the schools and I ask in advance that they send usually six students down to the gym. I'll say, send me the class clowns and send me some of the underdogs, because I include them in the presentation. And because I'm doing that, it's taking the class clowns out of the audience and putting them on stage where they're on their best behavior. And it's also taking some of those underdog students and giving them, that, I don't want to say voice, but giving them that, that attention or validation that they sometimes seek. And I, make them look like they're my best friends, because really I was the underdog. And I just find ways to incorporate students into the presentation to make everybody feel like this is for everyone.
Nice. Well, I recognize that the class clowns probably know that they're class clowns. I'm curious as to whether the underdogs know that they're the underdogs. I wonder if there's a, I got called to be one of the people on the stage. That's great. Oh yeah, you got called because you're an underdog. Wait, what?
I like those kids that, you know, the ones that are, you know, sometimes in the special education classes and that get picked on and bullied. Those are the ones I want because that's the student I was.
Okay.
Gotcha. I was that kid that struggled.
Nice. So when it comes to speaking, do you ever get nervous before a presentation? And if so, what do you do to deal with your nerves?
The only time I get nervous before a presentation is when I'm speaking to adults. I have no issue with youth. And the truth is, it's the reason I get nervous when I speak to adults is I always was under the impression like they know more than me. They know more than me about so much of the industry, and I would get super nervous. I still do, but I also keep in mind that they don't know my story and I'm telling them my story. And also if they ask me questions that I can't answer, I've become very comfortable with saying like, I'm sorry, I can't answer that question. You know, if you would like, I can get in touch with you via email or a phone call later on and find out for you.
Nice. I mean, one of the other things I mentioned in the intro is that you're an author. So maybe you could tell us a bit about your author journey.
Yeah, that's so it's a very interesting story. So I when I started doing a lot more of this public speaking and became more professional speaker, lots of times magazines and newspapers would be at different events that I was at. And eventually they started asking me interview questions and everything. And I screwed a few of them up. So I ended up taking media training and learned more about writing. And now I get offered to write a lot of articles for different magazines. But where was I going with this? Because now I forget what you asked me.
About your author journey.
Oh, yes. So author journey. So I was writing articles for magazines. And then somebody told me, you know, as a professional speaker, it's really smart to have a book, an autobiography or something. So I was talking to my business partner down in LA. She's a stationary operating engineer who's now retired. I was telling her, you know, people keep telling me I got to write this book. And I don't even know if I have the attention span to sit down and write the first chapter. I have a hard time writing an article. And I said, but I work with kids. And she came up with this idea. She said, well, there was this organization years ago that did a coloring book aimed at, you know, young women to get them interested in skilled trades. And this is going back to the 70s. And she said, would you ever consider doing something like that? So she brought in an artist who ended up becoming like a mastermind behind our All the Kids on Builder Street series. And we ended up, the three of us together, collaborating. And so I'm actually a co-author. And we ended up creating this All the Kids on Builder Street series for elementary students. And throughout the series, there's going to be 5 books. We're just putting the last 3 out over the summer. And they feature 90 skilled trades between the 5 books. So 18 per book. That's just kind of how it came out. So now we have this whole kids coloring book series, and that's what I'm the co-author of.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. So the coloring book is for little kids, I'm guessing.
Yes. Yes. So from pre-kindergarten, we've gone all the way up to grade 5 with the coloring books. I thought it might be juvenile for grade 5s, but they just love it because they're learning all these different skill trades that they would have never understood prior to these coloring books.
Pre-pandemic, I went to an event and they had coloring sheets on the table for the attendees. So the adults were actually taking these pieces of paper and actually coloring them. And I just remember thinking to myself, wow, I guess some things you never outgrow. Some that you thought was juvenile for fifth graders. Hey, you got grown people want to color things.
Oh, absolutely. We go to a conference every single year called Women Build Nations. It's this year, there was 3,300 people there. It was in Vegas. Over 3,000 tradeswomen from across Canada and the United States and a few other countries globally were there. At these conferences, our coloring books are like, the women buy them like crazy. They love them and they color them as well because it represents something we're all so passionate about, and that's skilled trades and speaking to students about future opportunities in this industry.
Wonderful. Well, you know, Jamie, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for being a guest. How can people get in touch with you?
Well, you can find me on LinkedIn. You can go to the kickasscareers.ca website. And as of hopefully this Friday, I will be launching my newest website that speaks more to the corporate audience, and that is madeinthetrade.com.
Excellent. Well, everyone, that marks the end of another edition of Teach the Geek Interviews. My name is Neil Thompson. I'm the founder of Teach the Geek. I work with technical professionals so they can present more effectively, especially in front of non-technical audiences. And you can learn more about that at teachthegeek.com. Again, that's teachthegeek.com. Until next time, take care and stay safe. Thanks, Jamie.
Thank you so much. This was awesome.
Well, everyone, that marks another episode in the can. I hope you enjoyed it. If you like these episodes and want to support Teach the Geek, please subscribe, share, and like on any of your favorite podcast platforms, or on all of them. Also, if you prefer to watch the episodes, head on over to the YouTube channel at youtube.teachthegeek.com. Until next time.